All right, I'm going to be talking specifically about two new paradigms for machine translation. New meaning that they've come out in the last three years or so. Context-based machine translation and statistical transfer approaches to machine translation. And it should become clear what they are as I talk about them. This is my diagram from yesterday, and just to situate it, context-based machine translation is a corpus-based method that uses unsupervised learning techniques. It derives motivation from statistical, from example-based machine translation. And the other one, statistical transfer, is one that strives to learn new transfer rules automatically to augment human-created ones or to replace human-created ones for a new language pair. So, let me start with a reminder of something that is probably well recognized by the majority here, but we need context to resolve ambiguity in language in order to translate. Here we have an example from English to Japanese. I chose these languages so that people couldn't contradict me too much, although I don't believe I see the gentleman from Japan present, so nobody can probably contradict me too much. If you have to translate the word line in English into Japanese, there are, I think, 53 different ways to translate it. Here, this is just a sample of them. If you say power line, that's one word. Densen, subway line is different. Interestingly, the third one here, be online, that really says online, mispronounced, and is written in Hiragana or katakana instead of kanji because it's a borrowed word from outside the language, and so on. And in all of these examples, local context, namely two, three, four words surrounding it, suffices to disambiguate. This is the power of example-based machine translation and in particular statistical machine translation. They remember all these short n-gram translations as part of the translation model and can get lexically the right things in the right places, some of the time, those times when local context suffices. But local context does not always suffice. Let's look at these examples up here. The line for the new play extended for three blocks. Well, it's not so clear what line means. If line for the play, that might mean an actor's line. So local context is, in fact, misleading here. You're talking about a cue instead. The line for the new play was changed by the scriptwriter. This time you do mean the line that the actor is supposed to say. The line for the new play got tangled with other props. Oops, that means possibly something like a rope. The line for the new play better protected the quarterback. Sorry, this is a bad example outside the United States. This is from American football. Quarterback is the main player who throws the ball, and the line is the players in front of him that keep protecting from being mauled by the opposition team. Okay, so in this case, play is also ambiguous. It refers to not a theater play. And so the problem with all of these cases is that you need long-distance dependencies in order to disambiguate semantically. The reason I'm using these examples is that everybody uses long-distance dependencies in syntactic manipulation in order to get the sentence structure right. That long-distance dependency is also important. But since nobody was making a big deal out of semantic long-distance dependency, I thought I would add it too to the mix of things that need to be resolved, not to replace the necessity for the other dependency, but to augment it. And so the context-based machine translation approach that I'm going to describe it fairly rapidly because of time constraints, is one that uses significantly longer context to produce the candidate translations, and then uses something called an overlap decoder to cascade concept across the entire sentence. Notice that there's still extra sentential context. There's more context than this that's also required, but this goes a long step beyond the three-word or four-word context in the n-grams. So the challenge is that in machine translation, there will never be enough parallel text. Parallel text is great. You use it, you exploit it as much as you have, but if I try to extrapolate from Franz Och graphs, remember it was a logarithmic x-axis, you would need between 100 and 10,000 times as much in order to achieve levels that are more corresponding to the human translation, in order to achieve, you know, a reduction by half in the residual error rate. And this much, you can probably get twice or three times as much parallel text, but it's hard to imagine getting 10,000 times as much parallel text. So what do? We look at monolingual text, that there exists a million times as much as parallel text, 10 million times as much. That's called also unlabeled text. It doesn't come with a translation, and the question is how to exploit that text. And that's what this approach does. It does not require parallel text. It does require a fully inflected bilingual dictionary. So it does require a human-created resource, but it's a finite resource. You can get the uninflected dictionary and then run an automatic process to generate all the corresponding inflections, which is exactly what's done. So this is the obligatory architecture slide. We take the input sentence, divide it into overlapping n-grams, and then there are two processes, one's called a flutter, another an overlap decoder, that do the bulk of the work in the translation. And this is what I'm going to describe. These three, this one is trivial, and these two are non-trivial processes in red. The rest are just information sources that are added to the system. The one on the left are textual resources. The one on the right are just simply to speed up the processing. So let's take a sentence. Call this source word one, source word two, source word three, and so forth. Let's break it into overlapping windows. Typically, these are 8-gram or 10-gram windows. For convenience, I'm using 5 grams to show on this slide because it fits better for no other reason. And let's look at one of these, the second one of these n-grams, and we'll use the inflected bilingual dictionary to generate all the word translations. These are word-to-word or phrase-to-phrase translations. Phrasal translations also work, whether it's one-to-many, many-to-one, or many-to-many. And we generate all the translation candidates. So this little table says that this source word can translate to any one of these target words, and that source word can translate into any one of those, and so forth. We call this the flooding set. And what we are trying to do is to find in a target corpus, this is translation by search and lookup. This is translation by cheating. We're not actually building a new translation. We're looking up things that have already been said in the target language. And so what we're looking is, here's a fragment of something that has been said that contains 3 of these words, one from each column. And that's a translation candidate for this n-gram. Here's one that contains 4. Notice that there's arbitrary reordering within this n-gram. That's okay. Here's another one that contains a different 4 with different kind of reordering. So what do we get? We get a set of candidate translations, not all the same length. And we're then trying to score them with respect to proximity, in other words, purity, fewest untranslated things inside, with respect to maximum coverage, with respect to probability of individual translations, if the dictionary is a probabilistic dictionary, and a plethora of other scoring techniques. So just like that, we will generate multiple translation candidates for the second n-gram. We do that for the first one, the second, the third one, the fourth one, the fifth one, and so on. Remember, these are overlapping. You switch the window by one to the right at each time. And we don't generate 3, we generate about 1,000. I'm not very good at drawing 1,000 examples in each and keeping the slide legible, so 3 will have to stand in for 1,000. You know, change the base and you're okay. All right, so what we're trying to do now is the last step, which is the maximal overlap decoding step. That was the end of the flooding step. So we take the first one of these candidate translations, and the suffix has to match the prefix of another one. So this one matches that, this matches that, this matches that, and that means that these two are compatible translations. And so what we try to do is find something that approximates a completely compatible translation across the entire sentence. There in beige, you find another fully compatible translation among these first 3. And what we do is now we have alternates that are fully compatible. Sometimes we have only one, sometimes we have 0. Then we find the one that's closest to fully compatible. And then we run our scoring algorithm to determine which are the best ones there. And then these scoring algorithms are based on many of the same probabilistics that come from phrasal translation probabilities and word translation probabilities, and also the probability of this being a well-structured thing using a standard language modeling of a target language. And this is the same thing except with real words put in there as an overlap decoding, and you get something like that. And so what kind of quality translation do we get using this? So that's the end of the translation process. I just described it. This is compared. These are all Spanish to English translations in this bracket, so they are comparable. These are blue scores using four reference translations, so they are higher than blue scores when you use a single reference translation. This is the word that NIST tends to score. Sistren and SDL, two popular rule-based languages. There is Google doing very well, and this method is doing marginally better. And this one is the same method, except we're cheating. We're cheating by adding a word to the dictionary if it wasn't there. The middle one here is the one without cheating. The interesting thing about the cheating line is that that's the way we develop our system. And then when a dictionary was big enough, we hooked it in. And then the dictionary is getting better, so now the difference between the cheating and the real one is almost nothing. So basically, once the dictionary size gets to be a certain point, it catches up with the best it could possibly do, algorithmically best it could possibly do. And so that's how that method works. By the way, if you want to see an output, this is a sentence from about 3 years ago, which we translated with a context-based machine translation. It comes out as a virtually perfect translation. An American soldier would be a slightly better way of saying it. By the way, Google's, I plugged it in last night, and it comes up with exactly the same answer. Now, I don't know if it's because their system is also really great or because they found this as parallel text somewhere in the examples. automatically, of course, in there. But word for word, it comes out exactly the same. Usually when I type something in, it may also come out very good, but it's not word for word identical. You can tell that the Sistren translation here leaves something to be desired. It's not a soldier of the wounded United States, and it's not an outbreak of an explosive device. It's an explosion and so on. So the lexical selection in this case. All right, so that was one method. There is a couple of problems with this method, one of which is what if we do not find a word in the dictionary or a phrase in the dictionary? Then what we want to do is we want to find a synonym or a near synonym and translate that. And what if the overlap decoder fails to confirm any translation? Well, there may be an equivalent translation, a synonymous way of saying or near synonymous way of saying that would permit the overlap to go ahead. In both cases, it requires finding synonyms, word or phrase synonyms, in one case in the source, in the other case in the target. So what you really need here is an automatic synonym finder. Well, this could be a little bit like your recipe for unicorn stew. First, find a unicorn. But fortunately, we do have a pretty good synonym finder here, so it's not quite as mythical as unicorns. And that is another unsupervised learning technique. So suppose that we want to find synonyms for stock market. The system looks at left context and right context, variable length right context over, you know, gigabytes of data, and then finds other things that could occur in exactly those same contexts. The more the better, and the longer the context, the better. And following that process, we generate things like market, stock exchange, national market, equities market, et cetera, as synonyms for it. Here's a few other synonyms that are generated for conference, meeting, symposium, convention. It's safe to say, it came up with, it's fair to say, it's important to note, and so forth, other expressions that are similar. And interesting, it also finds spelling variants. Our newspaper reporters have no idea how to spell Al-Qaeda correctly. Maybe there isn't a single correct spelling, but you type one of them and it finds the alternatives because it's the closest thing to itself. It's a synonym, it's just an orthographic variant. Okay, so that's the end of the first method. It's a new paradigm. It works very well, but it hasn't yet been sort of scaled up to work across multiple different languages. Okay, so let me tell you about another method called statistical transfer, which is in trying to build a method for inducing transfer rules from text. It requires the ability to parse, though. Now, the parses can be statistical parses and so forth. And it, the whole purpose of it is that you don't have to write transfer rules. Now, if you're talking about 100 languages, you would need 200 parsers as opposed to 10,000 sets of transfer rules. So it's still economical, even if you have to build the parsers. You're reducing an n squared to a 2n problem, assuming that the whole method works. The framework is essentially similar to a statistical machine learning, machine translation method, in that it also uses parallel text. In other words, it's completely different from the one that I just talked about. It's, just, it's a different paradigm. And in terms of the triangle that we talked about before, it's essentially the transfer rules that it learns are partially lexicalized, partially with semantic categories, and partially with syntactic categories. So it doesn't fit as a horizontal line anywhere, but rather some parts are closer to a direct transfer, some parts are closer to a tree transfer. The major part is closer to a tree transfer. And so let's see what we do. We first do a word alignment, word and phrase alignment between the source and target. We parse the sentences on both languages. And this is winds up being phrase structure parsers. We're also experimenting with dependency parsers. And then we do tree-to-tree constituent alignment, which is induced from the parse tree and the initial word alignment. And we enhance the alignment with additional projections if there are things that have not been aligned, but by the pigeonholing principle have to align to each other because of the adjacent ones that have aligned, we project them as well. And then we extract the aligned constituents into transfer rules. And we generalize from the individual words into the categories that they represent in the trees. And then this constructs this so-called database. So how does it work as an example? If we find a parse here in Chinese and a parse here in English, and we have a alignment, notice not a complete alignment at the word and phrasal level, the next step that we do is that we include that alignment, we project that alignment into the corresponding trees. Notice that we have a color coded here. This part of S tree corresponds to that part of the tree. This part of this tree corresponds to that part of that tree, and so forth. So it allows for long-distance movements at this intential level. It doesn't always get them right. In fact, far from it. We would love for them to get it right most of the time. Then we would have a wonderful system, but at least it allows for them. If we could only learn better how to do this, then we would have high-quality transfer rules learned automatically. Okay. So those were the main details, technical details that I wanted to present, and I want to end now with some more philosophical remarks. The first is that this is not the end of the creation of new paradigms in machine translation. Asking which of the existing paradigms will be the ultimate winner is a self-defeating question. It presupposes that there will be no new ones. Okay, and I do not want to presuppose that. I do not want anybody to presuppose that, except if it's somebody I particularly don't like. But the point is that we should keep our creative juices flowing. Now, the new paradigms might be radically different or might be derived from the existing ones or might be recombinant versions using parts of the existing ones like the transfer rule-based transfer one that I presented or more radically different like the context-based machine translation that I presented today. So even for paradigmatic zealots, and there are none of those here, of course, why can't we learn rules automatically? Why do we have to have either rules or statistical phrasal transfer tables? Why can't we rely on this huge monolingual or otherwise unlabeled text resources? The machine learning world is improving at combining labeled and unlabeled data, small amounts of labeled data with huge amounts of unlabeled data for other tasks. ordering tasks, structural learning tasks, and so forth, not machine learning per se. If they can do it for those simpler tasks, we can do it for our more complex task of machine learning. And let me give you two cautions here. One of them is a quote from Herb Simon, who's a Nobel laureate, and he said, "Rigor engenders science, alas, also mortis." Okay, so you have to scratch your head for a while to figure out what was he smoking when he said that. But what he meant is that you want scientific rigor in everything, but you don't want it to extend to eliminating creativity. So it's perfectly okay to have new ideas that are not yet rigorous and then grow them to be rigorous. I mean, even Albert Einstein did that in one of his Gedanken experiments. What would it be like if I was traveling along with a photon at the speed of light? Now, what kind of a ridiculous question is that? It's not even physically possible. Yet it led to his very rigorous discoveries of general relativity that followed next. So it's a combination of creativity and rigor. The two should never be presented as one excluding the other. There's a certain order to them. First, you get creative, and then you get rigorous, typically. And also, the second caution is one of my own that says there is a huge difference between a general system theory and a system that respects it. In particular, statistical decision theory and machine learning are very broad theories, and statistical machine translation, as it is embodied in today's present form, is one implementation or one system that respects it and implements according to that particular theory. Okay, for that reason, it may be very good, as Franz and others have said so, and I have no quibble with that, but there can be many other methods that are also based on these theories that are not that wouldn't look anything like the current version of statistical machine translation. They could be using semantic structures inside them, for example, and still respect optimizing decisions internal to them. All right, that's it. I'm not going to answer that question. Okay, so let me just say that the first one is not quite so minor.
No, I didn't say it was.
Yeah.
No, the first one is quite interesting.
No. The first, sorry, not the first paradigm, the first of the two variants.
Well, actually, other people tried what you're doing and found that it didn't work as well because of parse errors. When they tried to use constraints from two parse trees, they just didn't get enough correspondence between the structures. So, Daniel Bay in his postdoc work tried basically exactly what you're doing, it just didn't work very well.
Right, and the main trick here is to find those correspondences by relaxing the mapping process in such a way that you get better mappings than you would by applying a single parser and then projecting that syntactic structure onto the target language, whose structure may be completely different than the former language. So to the degree that both languages are fairly close to begin with, the projection techniques actually are pretty good. And to the degree that the two languages are structurally very different, assuming that one can be projected directly from the other one is not optimal, let's say.
Well, I don't want to take issue with you on what method works better, but just to make the point, I think it's pretty misleading to describe it as a radically new approach, because it's a very, very
well, we'll take issue on the degree of whether it's minor or major. But I agree that there's been attempts that were similar to it before. I have a very good answer, but you won't like it. We wanted to have the longest ones that the computation would finish before next week. In other words, 10 works better than 8. It takes about 4 times longer to compute. 12 will take another 4 times longer, and it was intolerable with our computing resources available. No, because we haven't tried 12, but I can tell you how much better 10 worked than 8, which is roughly 7% better. So there's still room to improve by just improving that window size.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.